Morning.
Good morning.
And good morning. So this morning I'm going to begin by telling a story that I heard in my Sunday school class when I was a kid that probably most of you know and that I've told before. There were four blind men, and they were approaching an elephant. And the first blind man approached the elephant from the front and felt its trunk, and he said, "Oh, what a good hose! What a good hose! This is bigger than any hose that I know." And the second blind man who was blind, approached the elephant from the side, and he said, "Oh, what a solid wall. I wish my house could have solid walls like this." The third blind man who was blind, approached one of the legs, touched the leg, fell out. He said, "Boy, what a solid tree trunk. I would like to have trees like that grow in my yard." And the fourth one went to the back, and he got swished by the elephant's tail. And he said, "Boy, that is a lively broom. I would like to steal that broom down. Maybe it could sweep the house itself without my having to do anything." And so then they gathered together and began talking about what they had experienced and arguing. And then, of course, they fought, right? They fought. They beat each other up, right? So this is about... This is a Zen story from my point of view, told by my minister years and years ago. But it's a Zen story. And it's about how our interpretations blind us to the large reality. And about how from our interpretations we develop a narrative fallacy. A narrative fallacy that we then carry around with us. And that narrative fallacy has resulted in all the wars that we've had in humankind, all the wars that we're having right now between whoever, Arabs and Israelis, U.S. and Iraq, Republicans and Democrats. It's that narrative fallacy that perpetuates that. And paradoxically, the more that we learn, the more we become wedded to our narrative fallacy. I watch Amy Goodman on TV. I don't know if you know Amy Goodman. That's who I watch. My wife's brother does Rush Limbaugh. So I'm with Amy Goodman. I get all my facts from her. He gets all his facts from Rush Limbaugh. So, well, it's the same process. It's the same process. The more we learn, the more justified we feel. Because we learn to reinforce our narrative. So that's a human situation, right? We do that. And the problem is, from a Zen point of view, that we concentrate on the things we know and fail to take into consideration the things we don't know. That we simplify, we categorize, and then we narrate. We simplify, we categorize, we narrate. Instead of imagining the impossible. Instead of going beyond the known. So a determination to do this is maybe the beginning of Zen practice, maybe the end of Zen practice, I don't know. But determination to do this, to see this narrative fallacy, and imagine the impossible, and go beyond the known. So a writer named Nassim Taleb has written a book about this stuff without knowing anything about Zen, which is cool. I always like that when I find a book written by someone who doesn't know anything about Zen that says the same thing that my teachers always said. And he has two examples of the narrative fallacy and the prediction, how our predictions are based on narrative fallacies. And one is, he calls How to Learn from the Turkey. And I assume that this is a that this is an organic, farm-raised turkey that he's talking about. Because in his situation, the turkey for 1,000 days gets fed every day, has a nice pen, gets handled well by human beings, has air to move around in, and this nice person takes care of him. So what kind of a prediction might he make? And what happens on the 1,001st day? On the 1,001st day, his narrative fallacy, his prediction. Well, and this is the human situation. This is the human situation. The Titanic is a good example. A second good example. The captain of the Titanic wrote in 1907, before he did the Titanic voyage, he wrote, "In all my experience, I have never been in any accident. I have seen only one vessel in all my years sailing around the world in distress, and never seen or been party to any situation which could end in disaster of any sort." And he said that in 1907. In 1912, he was dead, right? The company that financed the Titanic was, you know, really expensive, really expensive. The company who financed it had to get people to invest, right? The company made a statement that it had 12 risk managers who had used models of the past to tabulate that this was as safe an investment as a human being could make. So everybody rushed to invest in the Titanic. Everybody did. And then after something happens that shows that our prediction doesn't work, that our fallacy, that our narration is really a fallacy, well, what do? We do it again. After something happens that was bad, we develop a narrative to make us feel better. Right? So after that Titanic, if you can read about the narratives that they developed afterwards, the design had this kind of flaw, that kind of flaw, the other kind of flaw, there was this problem with the on and on and on, pages and pages and pages. As if it were bound to happen. We like to think that things are bound to happen. We like it. Because it gives us some security. It gives us some sense of maybe solidity, or like the world isn't too scary. And of course, practitioners of Eastern religion are just as guilty of this as anyone else. And we've been talking in my other classes about karma. We're going to be talking about it more because we're in a section on karma in Katagiri Roshi's book. But typical Hindu practice in regard to karma would be a sannyasin, a holy person, would break his arm. Then he would go into a cave and he would really meditate on what were the causes, the conditions that led to his breaking his arm. And he would review everything that he had done and not done until he could determine what bad karma had caused this. And if he couldn't find anything in this lifetime, what would he do? Go back to the previous lifetime. Of course, you know he's able to do that, right? He's a sannyasin. And we like to think that Buddhists don't do this, but Buddhists do this too. Now, Buddha... The historical Buddha supposedly didn't do this, talked about it differently. But if you hang around with Buddhists a lot. You see, they do it too. It's just the narrative fallacy from a nice Eastern point of view. And boy, what a tidy world. And it does promote ethical behavior in a way, doesn't it? Just like fear of hell promotes ethical behavior in a way, right? Is it? I don't think it's any different. Instead of the big Buddhist teaching that everything is the cause of everything else, that everything is the effect of everything else. But it's hard to develop a narrative about that, isn't it? What do you do about that? Not a narrative that makes you feel secure, that's for sure. Not a narrative that gives you any control, that's for sure. So, in Yogacara, which we looked at on Wednesday night in our Wednesday night group where we're reading Katagiri Roshi's book, they talk about three components of developing and sustaining our narrative fallacy: experience, perfume, seed, a waterfall of experience, perfume, and seed. I have the experience, it creates a perfume, which is an emotional memory. From that emotional memory, I project into the future with a seed. And then my next experience is affected by that previous one. So that promotes and secures our narrative fallacy. On and on and on. So, you guys had to get up an hour early this morning to come here today. Well, I had to get up an hour early to come here too. We had to get up an hour early because we're not used to this. And it still feels like winter outside. It doesn't feel like spring at all. But we did it. Well, I did it because I had to. You guys did it. You guys did it because you have some positive seeds from your experience being here before. You know, you have some positive seeds. You have more positive ones than negative ones, or you wouldn't have made it up an hour early this morning. So good for you. Good for you. And after I finish my talk, and then you go to coffee. We have our coffee and our tea and treats in the other room. Then we talk. And you're more likely to hang out with people whom you have, you're carrying positive seeds around about based on your previous experience with them. It's just human nature. Last time you had some neat talk with someone the time before, and that created a wonderful perfume, and that perfume coagulated. And that's your positive seed. Oh, I'll go talk to her. You do that. We do that. And that keeps our storyline going. keeps our narrative fallacy going. Maybe you don't want to call it a fallacy. That's okay. I'll call it a fallacy. So what do we do as Zen aspirants, if we realize that our storyline is a fallacy? Well, if we're becoming Zen students, serious Zen students, we begin to develop comfort with the unknown. We don't try to avoid predicting. We just know that when we predict, it may or may not work. It may or may not work. And the more comfortable we can be with the unknown, the more we can just have it work or not work. In Greek medicine, positive accidents were very, very important. Positive accidents. Central method of discovery in Greek medicine. And even in Western medicine, someone like Louis Pasteur, the great researcher, said, in research, don't look for a particular result. Just realize that chance favors the prepared. Chance favors the prepared. And what does Suzuki Roshi say? I put it in the program there. He said, enlightenment is an accident. Practice will makes you accident prone. Right? That's what he told me when I was pissing and moaning. And he said it somewhere in one of his books, too. So there are three main ways of making the self accident prone in Zen practice and Buddhist practice. Three main ways of cracking open the narrative fallacy. And the first, I talked about these on Wednesday night, for those of you who were there. The first is gathering moral provisions. Gathering moral provisions. Like, we're going on a trip. This Zen practice is a trip. We're going on a backpacking trip. We're going to the mountains. We've got to gather our provisions to sustain us. Our food, our moral food, our right speech, our right action, our honesty in our speech and our behavior, our not taking advantage of other people. Moral provisions, the precepts, the Eightfold Path, we're gathering those moral provisions. And by gathering those moral provisions, we're changing some negative seeds into positive ones. It's not that we're doing anything with the negative seeds, it's that we're creating a positive seed to counterbalance the negative one. So let's say that one of you determines that during coffee, which is coming up, that you're going to reach out to someone who you had bad vibes about last time or the time before. Well, that person gave me bad vibes. Well, bad perfume, right? Which creates negative seeds, right? And you avoid that person. But this time, you're going to say, I'm going to reach out to that person. I'm not just assuming that person is beyond the pale. I'm just not assuming I can't have a relationship with that person. That person has a heart that's beating and eyes that are opening and closed. And the same needs as I do, and I'm going to reach out to that person. Well, that's gathering a moral provision. That's creating a positive seed. And we can do that with our intentions to be supportive of each other, to manifest our lives as bodhisattvas, as beings who are there for each other. So that's the first way of making yourself accident prone. Breaking through your narrative fallacy. The second way is Zazen. Well, I shouldn't have to talk about Zazen, should I? Zazen, which is what we're all about here. Zen meditation. That's Zen meditation. At some point, we see how we do this. We see our minds, how this mind has this perfume, creates the seed, turns it into an experience which is not really beyond our imagination, just captured by our imagination. And in our Zazen, at some point, we're able to let that go. And the moment we let that go, the moment we do what Dogen calls the falling away of body and mind, there's no seeds being produced because we're just this. Or this is just this. This is just this. And the third way is wholehearted effort. And if you read Katagiri Roshi or Suzuki Roshi over and over and over again, they say the same thing. Really talking about these three in their own way. moral provision, zazen, and wholehearted effort. You can open any page in any of their books and you see the same thing. So wholehearted effort in whatever activity is, providing it's a moral activity, providing it's moral. Not moral in a sort of right and wrong kind of way. I think you know what I mean. If you give yourself to that activity, you're not creating a seed because you're so in that activity. There isn't even any you in it. It's just the activity itself. So what seed is there to... what the perfume is there to give off for the next moment? The next moment is just complete too. Each is complete. And there's no special idea of moments or not moments. They're just living, just dying. And the key to success at all three of these is willingness to fail. Willingness to fail. That's the key. That's why everybody gives up at Zen, wants to give up at Zen. I know. You do zazen for a while, then you stop, then you come back and try it again, then you stop. The key to the success of your zazen, the key to your success of your cracking open the narrative fallacy is a willingness to fail. That's all there is to it. That's all there is to it. Period. Not comma. Period. So Apelles, the Roman artist, was a man after my heart. Although I'm not an artist. He's still a man after my heart. He tried over and over again to paint. He wanted to paint a horse in motion. He wanted to capture a horse in motion. He tried. He missed it. People laughed at him. He kept trying, he kept trying, he kept trying. Finally, he got the legs down, so the legs seemed to be in motion. So he's had the whole body in motion. And he seemed to be close, but he couldn't get the foam on the mouth. Because he couldn't get that. He kept working at it, he kept working at it, kept failing. He'd rip it up and start again, rip it up and start again. Finally, one morning, or afternoon, or evening, he was doing it. And it was impossible, so he just picked up his sponge, which was full of yucky paint, and he tossed it at the wall. And where did it land? Foam. Foam on the horse's mouth. So Dogen says, a Zen master's life is one mistake after another. One mistake after another. We keep creating circumstances where an accident could happen. We keep creating them, regardless of what happens. We just keep creating. So if you come to see me in one-to-one, I want to encourage you in your meditation. I always want to encourage you. But if you say your meditation is going well, I say, good. If you say your meditation is going pretty well, I say, good. If you say your meditation is not going well, I say, great. If you are doing it, if you are making the effort to bring yourself back, to bring yourself back, to bring yourself back, then it's great. Great if you are, if it's not good, it's great. It's because you're opening yourself possibly to the unknown. You're almost ready. You're almost ready if you're continuing. If you're continuing, almost ready, let go of your narration. And it can happen at any time. So, you need to love to lose. And if you stay in this practice, you will begin to love to lose. You will begin to love it. Well, you love to win too. But you love them both. You love them both. Supposedly, and I don't know much about it, but supposedly, I've never read a biography of Einstein, but somebody was telling me while I was talking about this that Einstein had failure after failure after failure, but that he was willing to go beyond the known anyway. He was willing to go beyond what his culture reinforced him to do anyway. So, maybe he was a guy who loved to lose. I don't know. I don't know. So, in a way, we can say that doing zazen, that gathering together moral provisions, that making wholehearted effort, that these are all ways in which we are putting ourselves in situations where favorable outcomes are more likely than negative. That's all we can ever know. That's all we can ever know. If you want more than that, you're not going to get it. But if you keep doing that, putting yourself in a situation where a favorable outcome is more likely than an unfavorable one, you will crack open the narrative fallacy. Or it will. You won't crack it open. Excuse me. Because you, that commentator, is part of the narrative fallacy, right? Is the narrative fallacy. It will crack open. So instead of being embarrassed, ashamed, or discouraged about our failure, of course we are. We get embarrassed, we get discouraged, and we get ashamed. And then we constrict ourselves. We go back to the known. But if we use that as an opportunity, then who knows what might happen. And so I'd like to close this talk with a quote from Muhammad, but I don't know if this is in the Quran, because it's in Francis Bacon's essay on boldness. And I don't doubt if he had even read the Quran. Muhammad made the people believe he would call a mountain to him, and from the top of it offer up his prayers to observers of his law. The people assembled. Muhammad called the mountain to him again and again. But the mountain didn't move. Muhammad was never a whit embarrassed or ashamed, but said, if the mountain will not come to Muhammad, Muhammad will go to the mountain. This is actually kind of famous. Some of you guys may know this. Kind of famous. That's it. That's about all it is. Isn't anything more than that. You don't have to make anything more than that out of it. If you do, you've got a new storyline, which is fine. But if you practice in this way, sooner or later, even your new storyline will crack open. And then, who knows? Who knows? The whole elephant may appear. The whole elephant could appear. What would it look like? What would it be like? The whole elephant. Is it possible? Is this a fantasy? Maybe so, maybe not. Okay, that's what I wanted to say this morning. Questions, comments, stories, songs? Questions, comments, stories, songs?
Part of the narrative self. Am I making sense?
Well, you're beginning to make sense. Here. Say it a couple more times.
Okay, so let's say, think about our practice. So our practice helps us step away from the near self.
Mm-hmm.
And then we think about our daily life.
Mm-hmm.
While we can still operate from that place, the larger picture might be operating in the context of the near self. So by bringing ourselves back, I understand that for ourselves, as that is really not only challenging, but it's a good thing, but it's also challenging because we have to operate in this near fallacy. Because that, otherwise we wouldn't be able to operate.
That's right. That's right. That's why I said earlier on, we don't stop predicting. We still predict. I mean, because we do. It's good. Everybody predicts. It's healthy to predict. We just do it a little more lightly, realizing that it's just based on a story, based on a sequence of stories about events, and so we're not caught by the prediction.
But we're still operating that way. We can still do it.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure.
I don't know how.
No. Well, let's not take this to the other extreme. Louis Pasteur still did his research. Mm-hmm. He still used all of the best research methods prevalent at the time. He just didn't look for a particular result. And he realized that if he did this, something would happen. Or something might not happen. Instead of thinking, well, I expect A, and if A doesn't happen, then I'll be disappointed. And he kept himself open.
So, I have an example.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
So if he operated on that form, but he's operating in a society whose dominant theory is cognitive.
Right.
Which is a little bit different in this sense. So, yeah. So if he functioned in the society where the theory was cause and effect, but through the principles of the theory of relativity,
mm-hmm.
in the Western medical world. So, can you connect the dots that I'm having trouble connecting? His outcomes would be, different than what would come up in, let's say, Western medical society, right?
Well, of course, he was doing physics, not medicine. So I'm not exactly getting what you're saying, Lana, or what you're asking.
Okay, so I'll go more specifically to an example. I'm an acupuncturist, and I'm working in a Western medicine.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So I see part of the fallacy as operating there.
Oh, okay.
I see it as partial fallacy.
I see.
But if I am trying to operate in that structure in that system,
right,
and don't but operate only through the way I see things and I operate, I don't know, that might not lead to something good.
Well, that's right, but you just need to realize that all of these narratives, even the acupuncture narrative, is ultimately a fallacy. It's ultimately, I mean, this doesn't mean it's bad, it's just that we close down as if it were the way. This, Western medicine is the way, acupuncture is the way, and we close down on that, and then we lose our flexibility, we lose our openness, we lose our ability to interact with people in a just free-flowing way, because So yeah, you're in that situation, and those people's beliefs. They have that narration. You're carrying your own narration, and here we are. Here we are. Let's breathe together. Realize that these are all just narrations about the unknown, and we can make use of these. But know that between every thought, there's a space always. Between every narrative, there's a huge opening. Every portion of the narrative.
So if you're holding yourself to within a place that, and I'm not talking about labels, because even acupuncture is constricting, as you said, but mm-hmm. let's say you're holding yourself to what you're, you know, I think I better stop there, because if I give it some time, it probably will sort itself out.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
I was going to share with the group that I received this beautiful email this morning with these lovely pictures, which I did pass on to some of you here. And it was about, and some of you may have seen this, but it was about the photographer who was up in Churchill, and he had a sled and some dogs, and he had his, they weren't currently sledding, but the dogs were chained to the ground, so they were resting. And this huge polar bear was walking up to the dogs, and there was a photo of a couple dogs, and one was, like, viciously barking at the polar bear, and the other one wasn't. And then you see more photographs, and the photographer was debating about whether or not to shoot this polar bear because he was afraid his dogs were going to get killed and he'd be stranded. Well, he let go of his assumption that this polar bear was going to attack his dog. And what happened was the dogs and the polar bear ended up connecting in a really kind and loving way, and they started playing together and frolicking, and the bear ended up coming back each night to visit and play with the dog. So I just thought this totally applies to your talk of letting go of past assumptions that he knew what the outcome was going to be, because dogs were going to get hurt. And he just let go of that and had that thought, like, gosh, what would have happened if I would have just shot the bear out when it wasn't his intention to kill the bear?
Mm-hmm. That's a great example. Yeah, that's great. Now, where did you see that?
It's in an email. Should I send it to you?
Yes! Send it to me. Send it to me. Well, by all means. Anything else?
Yeah, and then there's Timothy Treadwell.
Pardon?
And then there's Timothy Treadwell. The guy got from Britain and got from there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Anybody else this morning? Yeah.
I'd like to speak a little bit about wholeheartedness. And I understand the principle.
Provisions?
Provisions and intent. But wholeheartedness, I mean, it's... in my mind, I keep getting the parallel of that as, like, single-mindedness, which I don't think it's necessary.
Well, I can speak a little bit more about wholeheartedness. Usually, we don't do activities in a wholehearted way because we're so involved in our internal dialogue. This activity that I'm going to do is leading to this other activity, and I remember the last activity. So we just don't engage in them with a whole heart, with an open heart, because there are means. Every activity is a means to something else. That activity will create perfume, which will create another seed, which will allow me to get something else. But wholehearted means that whatever the activity is, that we're just here. And we're with it. And, of course, our mind may be... doesn't mean our mind is completely still. Our mind may be churning around anyway, but we're not hypnotized by our mind. We're giving ourselves to listening to you. That's all I'm doing, listening to you. I'm not worrying about how I should answer or whether you gave a good had a good question or not. I'm just here with you, just enjoying it. There's always, almost always, a sense of enjoyment with wholeheartedness, but not happiness in I'm happy. That's your narrative. It's just enjoyment of being. If it's the dishes, if it's talking through the microphone, whatever. Wholeheartedness. But it takes practice. It takes practice. Because we were programmed to live in the before and after, not in the now. To worry about the before and after. Does that make sense? Anything else?